Hi everyone, I'm Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Our theme today, the nature of mind and consciousness in creation of narratives, worldviews, and the role in medicine and healing. My guest today to take us on this unique journey is Dr. Madhava Sethi. That's S-E-T-T-E-E. He is a board-certified physician. He is a senior staff anesthesiologist at Lawrence General Hospital in the Greater Boston area. He is also a senior scientific editor of Robert Kennedy Jr.'s Children's Health Defense publication, The Defender. He also has a background in engineering, receiving a degree from MIT, later worked for the aerospace and defense industries. This included a research expedition to the Arctic Polar Cap for the U.S. Naval Research Center. But also, he became at some point dissatisfied with the nature and purpose of defense work, and he went back to school to receive a medical degree from Baylor University College of Medicine and anesthesiology training at the University of Pennsylvania. He's put in 20 years of clinical work in the field. And now he's written a book. It's called Woke, An Anesthesiologist's View. Now, this is not like the woke generation and the woke philosophies today. But in the book, he explores whether we might be living in a dark age of unfounded beliefs rather than real knowledge, a culture unable to distinguish fact from fiction, and how we can better navigate the conflicting narratives that only give rise to more confusion and uncertainty rather than real solutions. His website, let me spell it for you, madhavasethymd.com. Nice to have you with us today.
It's great to be here, Gary. Thank you for having me on.
On our last program, we spent the entire hour a week ago challenging common myths that are taken as absolute gold standard truths by the entire medical and scientific establishment, the complete media organizations, and most of the government when it comes to our healthcare system. And I want to begin with some observation, and I'll give a longer overview and overarching view, because everything in life, everything is a spectrum. At one end, we are novices, we are beginning. And we try to see both from our own human experience and interrelationships with people and objects what a truth is to us, at least what our perception of a truth is. And our perceptions become most of our realities. But then we have input from people, and we have input on two levels. One input is on the physical level, showing us how to do things, how to drive a car, how to wash a dish, how to make a bed. Another's on the emotive level, how we should feel about things, molding our perception of our feelings. What is a good feeling, a wrong feeling, a happy, a sad, a positive, a negative? How to be outraged but not go rageful? How to be concerned about something but without becoming a part of the energy of that concern, therefore staying non-toxic in a toxic environment, staying positive in a negative environment. So we acknowledge that we have these feelings, and yet science refuses to accept that they're real. In fact, with rare exception, like a Dr. Stanley Krippner and Dr. Douglas Dean, Dr. Thomas Kruth, or Rath, we accept that everything is linear. Everything is kind of a Newtonian, Immanuel Kant reduction, meaning everything can be reduced down to something that's very simplistic, an atom, a gene, a genome. And that's why a lot of people, a lot of scientists are atheists and believe, okay, we have this life, when it's over. That's it. There's no afterlife, no reincarnation. And that's fine for them. And there's a whole group of scientists that control virtually everything on Wikipedia. They're called skeptics. And these skeptics don't believe in energy healing. Therefore, they don't believe that meditation and yoga and energy medicine play any role. If you have a good effect, it's because of placebo. You wanted to have a good effect, or you believed that you had a good effect. Or a nocebo, where you were made fearful of something and therefore you manifested your fear as a disease. Okay. And that's where that argument ends. And it's not open for discussion in their minds. And they are at the head of a whole school of healing that says, well, it really doesn't matter what you think, because your thoughts really don't have a whole lot to do with your biochemistry. But there's a whole body of scientific evidence, thousands and thousands of peer-reviewed studies showing the epigenetics actually exists, meaning what, going back at least seven generations, the emotions, the memory of those emotions are locked into your gene and therefore influence the action of the gene. So therefore, one day, you find that you have a hard time speaking with people. You're very shy. Or you find that it's very easy to speak with you. Everything that's in your mind, there's no filter. You just like to share it. You just like to talk with people. You're very comfortable. And we think that that has nothing to do with the memory of other people in our ancestry who had those characteristics. Now, we'll acknowledge the characteristics of gene, where if there's certain chemicals in our body that will differentiate us. Red hair, oh, we found that gene for the red hair. 6'2", we found that gene. But they will not acknowledge that we have a mind. They think it's just brain. That's it. Chemicals in the brain. Neuroscience shows chemicals in the brain cause us to have feelings, even experiencing something like being at death's door and seeing golden light in a tunnel, and our loved ones on the other side who've passed before us. That's all an illusion. No, that's real. And yet, my own work has shown that they're easily challengeable. Let me give you this example. And then as a scientist, as an engineer, as a medical doctor, tell me what I'm going to share with you is wrong. Show me its flaws. Deconstruct what I'm about to say, please. Every approximately 8 seconds, you're going to blink. Every person on the earth is going to blink. If they didn't blink, if animals didn't blink, then the eye would not have a coating, a moisture coating that will protect it from chafing and very quickly blindness. When you're sitting down, your heart beats at a certain rate. If you lay down, it slows down. Your pulse slows down. Your blood pressure slows down. Your blood sugar slows down. When you stand up, it speeds up, but only to a certain level. When you go to walk, a certain level of heartbeat. When you go to jog, a different level, at a higher level. When you're running and doing extreme exercise, your heart is pumping at a very fast rate. And we can measure these rates. It won't go above a certain rate, but it doesn't go below a certain rate. Now, if you're overweight, the body's heart doesn't grow in proportion to your overweight. And yet, the heart still has to pump blood, so it has to pump harder. So how does the heart know to pump harder? How? Where did it get that message? If you eat chicken, the body will digest it. A hydrochloric acid will be secreted, and pepsin and pepsigen and enzymes in the stomach will help break down the chicken, the protein, the amino acids that are the building blocks of life. But if you eat tofu, it'll digest it differently. If you eat brown rice, it'll digest it differently than sugar that requires no digestion. If you eat anything with fat, suddenly a whole nother mechanism with the gallbladder, and you'll start secreting bile, which helps break down fat in the intestine. How does the stomach know if there's too much food in the stomach that a small flap at the bottom of the stomach, pyloric sphincter muscle, opens and food is just thrown into there? It's purged into it, but not fully digested. Well, how can the body take nutrients out of something that's not fully digested? The answer is it can't, but it can take calories out. So that way we can be overfed and undernourished. Well, what happens then? Then we don't get the nutrients. So almost all these overweight people are nutrient deficient. I see. So how does the body know to have the food travel through the peristaltic motion, the wave-like rhythmic movement, like a snake on the ground moving? Our intestine has both a biochemical and electrical charge that allows it to move food through. Otherwise, we would never have food get to the duodenum where the nutrients are absorbed. Must have a brain. Well, there's no brain there. There must be some kind of neuron activity in the intestine. We can't find neuron cells in the intestine. Oh, but the intestines do have the same capacity in many respects as the neurons in the brain. We've proven this. Well, how's that happen? Yeah. And the microbiome, the gut bacteria, can directly impact your immune system, and does. And if you have bad bacteria, it can adversely affect your immune system. Good bacteria helps your immune system. And how is it? How is it that you know how to sleep and wake up without an alarm clock? What's going on in that brain that's allowing it to say, okay, time to wake up, it's 5 o'clock, 4 o'clock, 6 o'clock. And how's it know when to go to sleep when it's not interfered with? But it does. And why is it only then that the melatonin is secreted from the pineal gland that helps with our entire immune system? And how is it that you have somewhere between 25 to 50 trillion cells all working in perfect harmony when you can't get three people to work in harmony? And it's working in perfect harmony your entire life, even when you're giving it information that is toxic and negative, and when you're giving it food that is toxic and negative, it still forgives you. Where did the body learn to forgive you and go in and heal the damage you've done? 60% of the liver can be regrown. How did it know to do that? And the last point is this. There is no mechanism ever found yet in the human body that can create balance in the body. And what I mean is that if you were to eat 20 extra pounds in a month, the body will not put it all in one place. Theoretically, there is no mechanism known that will tell the body, put this extra 10 pounds this month under your right arm, or on your neck, or on one calf. And yet it will put the weight on to maintain your balance. You won't get fat just in the belly. Your buttocks will get fat, your thighs, your upper thighs and your inner thighs. Your body will do everything it can to maintain balance so you don't fall over. Well, how did it learn that? I worked in the laboratory for 38 years as a senior research fellow. I did over 173 different experiments, some unique, and many of them you're not even aware that therapeutic touch. That was the work that I created, where I showed people can actually exchange energy into a rat without touching the rat. That showed and proved for the first time scientifically in world history that energy transfers from one person to another. But you didn't have to have me say that, and I didn't have to prove that to let everyone know. Ask a mother why she kisses her baby. And every mother kisses the baby because the mother is picking up on the lips and the saliva of the baby any antigen that creates an antibody in the mother, and it's passed through into the breast milk. Who taught it to do that? Who taught it to coo? Who taught it to bring it to its breast? How did it know its breast was for the baby to feed? How did the body know how to maintain its weight and lose weight proportional so it doesn't lose its balance? You don't lose weight around the belly first. You lose the upper part of the body. So you never lose balance. These are the things we do not talk about because they're outside the realm of general science, mechanical science, applied science, and basic science. And yet, ask someone who's in the process of having love and comfort and watch them have a different feeling. Give someone encouragement. Say kind words to them. Be there as a support system. A look from the eye. And suddenly someone has the confidence. Every kid looks at their parents. They're looking at their facial movement. They're feeling the vibration. And didn't we have a whole song by the Fifth Dimension, Good Vibrations? Haven't we been there, at least metaphorically, in the fifth dimension? Yeah. And yet it's completely denied by virtually all science and medicine today. And what if they use that in the healing? Wouldn't it make a difference then to eat a natural organic food that has the right energy versus a synthetic, chemically altered food, genetically manufactured? Yes, it would. But we're paying no attention to any of this. That's why my guest is here. I gave you a very long introduction. I'm going to stay silent now because it's a very deep subject. And I want you to talk now, if you would please, about a continuation of our last conversation addressing COVID and vaccines. But now we're going to explore the nature of mind and consciousness behind the creation of narratives, both factual and fictional, because almost all of our narratives today are fictional. Every major institution, our religious institutions, our financial institutions, our agricultural institutions, our manufacturing institutions, all have betrayed us because we're living with false narratives. This is something I have faced my entire adult life since I started advocating for natural health over 50 years ago. And finally, there was a lecture I did at the Roosevelt Hotel Grand Ballroom. It was packed, about 3,500 people standing and sitting. A reporter was there to do a story on me, and I knew it was going to be an attack story because they had gotten the word, is Gary Null really a healer and or just a hustler? And the only person that they took as taking the opposite side was a quackbuster who makes their living off attacking everyone in the field. And I was the leading person in the health field. And so I simply asked a question to the audience. How many doctors in the audience, nurses in the audience, hands went up. How many of you used my protocols and saw positive results on your own family or yourself? Hands went up. How many people were able to stop terminal illnesses? Hands went up. Reverse those illnesses? Hands went up. How many school teachers here have taught principles you've heard over the air, read in the books? Hands went up. How many have seen healthier students? Hands went up. How many people in here had arthritis, diabetes, and no longer have it because you changed your lifestyle and behavior? Hands went up. So I turned to the reporter. I said, you don't have to ask me anything. Don't ask me, because I could be biased. Why don't you ask these thousands of people, since they're here and they're giving testimony, their own? Not a single person was asked a single question. Not a single person. Thousands and thousands and thousands of records of people came to the Tri-State Healing Center. Not a single person was interviewed, including people who were at death's door with stage 4 cancers and full-blown AIDS, all cured. Not a single person was asked a question. Fritz Perl, the father of Gestalt psychology, said it best, a fear of knowing is a fear of doing. The establishment doesn't want to know this information because it doesn't know how to handle it. Could you take it from there, please? The forum is yours.
Well, that was quite an introduction, and you covered some very, very vital perspectives and facts. And I'm gonna start this way, which is something very important that you brought up about how we believe and how we know things. And as you've just described there with that particular anecdote, media, which as we know is corporately funded, will only selectively report on things. And sadly, much of our believing is actually based in our trust in the media, as opposed to what we think we're trusting, which is, you know, our scientific experts. Because as we know, there are scientific experts that disagree. And yet we believe, and by we, I'm saying the majority of people, we believe the ones that the media validates as being correct. So right away, we're starting from a place where there is bias being introduced into what we're being offered. Now, that being the case, I feel that it is best to, in order to engage intelligently and productively, rather than pushing alternative facts. And by alternative facts, I'm not talking about facts that aren't really facts, but facts that come from the fields that you've been working on, Gary, for decades. Many people who are entrenched in the conventional way of looking at things are unwilling to grant any of those positions any attention for the reasons I just explored. So it's often more productive to point out the double standards and hypocrisy coming from the sources that most people believe. So, you know, one place where we can start was with your introduction of the concept of a placebo. And I believe that there is, first of all, we have to say that they absolutely believe that the placebo, there is such a thing as a placebo effect, because that is the way that they prove efficacy of their pharmaceuticals, is that you have to test it against a placebo, because that effect must be real. So if they're seeing, if they're actually saying that thoughts make no difference, then they're caught in hypocrisy right there. Why test it against the placebo? They do. But what I experienced from my years in medical school was the initial impression that we don't really know what we're doing. You know, and it may sound destructive coming from a physician, but I'm just telling you my own experience, because let's be real here. If we have to spend an inordinate amount of money to create a trial where we're comparing a pharmaceutical against a placebo and enrolling thousands of patients to prove something that can be detected as a benefit, then we must conclude that whatever effect that we are introducing into the person is small to begin with, right? Because if that's what's required to prove that it works, it's probably not as effective as we'd like. But more importantly, it should point to the fact that we really don't understand what is happening behind the physiology of a human being if your product has to be tested against a placebo. But the thing that struck me the most in my medical training in medical school was, why were we so confident in our positions about anything? And this sort of goes back to what we're facing right now with the, you know, around vaccine hesitancy or the skepticism people have about the medical field. I think it's very justified. And part of that is the confidence by which we are being dictated what should be done, whether that be in a pandemic emergency. And I believe that we're in a crisis, not of epidemiological of a epidemiological nature. This is an epistemological crisis that we're in. Like, how do we know exactly what we know? Like, what is the proof for a belief? What is the proof for knowing? And it so happens that I happen to be an anesthesiologist. And, you know, when people are asked, what is the greatest contribution of Western medicine to society? Many people will cite vaccines or antibiotics or something like that. But in my opinion, and, you know, I'm trying to be as unbiased as I can, I think it's anesthesia, because most of the interventions that Western medicine is able to offer the public that are truly transformative and can help people are surgical interventions. Most of medical doctors are treating chronic diseases, and they're not curing them. They're just ameliorating the symptoms and potentially extending life for a nominal amount of time, depending on what study you're looking at and what disease we're talking about. But most of the surgical interventions that we have available to us are only possible because we have anesthesia. I mean, you know, people would die of acute appendicitis if you couldn't take the appendix out. People would walk around, you know, for decades with malformed bones that could not be surgically corrected. You know, the list goes on and on and on. But here's what's really interesting, Gary, is that anesthesia is an enormous mystery. The anesthetic agents that we use, and by the agents that I'm referring to here are inhaled agents. We use things like sevoflurane and desflurane, isoflurane. These are relatively new agents, but they work in a mysterious way, just like ether. And, you know, from a historical perspective, ether was first demonstrated publicly not so far from where I live here in Boston at a place called the Ether Dome at Mass General Hospital. And it was 1847. And what happened was there was an audience of dozens and dozens of physicians, most of them who were surgeons, who witnessed a young man have a tumor removed from his neck. And the patient was given ether and went to sleep, if you will, and the tumor was removed. And when he emerged from his state of unconsciousness, he said he had no recollection of the operation, and nor did he feel anything uncomfortable, no pain. And it is said that half of the people there who were surgeons wept when they saw this experiment. And the reason for that, of course, is that they've spent their lives having to, barbarically operate with nothing but, you know, whiskey and a piece of leather for the patient to chew on as these procedures were performed back then. Now, what's interesting about this is that we still don't know how ether works. And you want me to continue, Gary, or did you want to?
Yes, no.
Okay.
I gave a long introduction. So, by the way, just so I make it clear,
yeah,
there's a whole concept called idiot savant, meaning a person who cannot learn, cannot be taught, and therefore will never be able to go to a school, etc., yet has unique skills that cannot be explained. I work with individuals, and what I'm saying is that explain to me how all these things happen in the body, and yet there's no scientific explanation for them, because all the cells were born, and therefore they had to have these lessons already in them. No cell in the body was taught how to digest fish, but it knows how to do all this. Therefore, there is an innate intelligence in the body, and it goes beyond that of the brain. And we've refused to acknowledge this. And if we refuse to acknowledge this, and we refuse to acknowledge that feelings actually can manifest in positive health, healing, happiness, joy, etc. That's what I was referring to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. I mean, our emotional state has a very large bearing on our health. I'm going to get back to the anesthesia history and why it's such an important story in a moment. But with regard to what you just said there, I have chaperoned 20,000 people in and out of very deep states of unconsciousness in my career. And when I was first training, one of my mentors, every time he was starting general anesthesia through an IV with someone, he would always say something like, so when you wake up, you're going to be hungry. And he was known for that. And not too many people asked him why he said that, but I did. And what he was saying was, look, we have an opportunity here to engage with the subconscious mind. And one of the common side effects of general anesthesia is nausea. But, you know, he was trained in hypnosis and NLP. And he said, you know, the reason why he suggested that they would wake up hungry is because you cannot be hungry and nauseated at the same time. And if you just said you're going to wake up and not be nauseous, that's not what the subconscious hears. The subconscious only hears the word nauseous, not. So he introduced to me the idea of using hypnotic therapy during anesthesia, when there is a period where the same EEG patterns that are present in a hypnotic induction are present during the delivery of anesthesia. And so I have been doing the same thing in my practice and offering suggestions of health, of quick recovery, of no pain, of being hungry, being excited about life in those brief 10, 20 seconds prior to the induction of a deep anesthetic state. But in any case, the reason why this mystery is so important, about why we have not uncovered the mechanism of anesthesia and anesthetics has to do with the way we're framing the problem, because in Western medicine, it's a very reductionist approach to explaining things. It always comes down to molecules. When Western medicine says, oh, we know how that drug works, what they're really saying is that we have identified the molecules that are involved in how they interface with the body. It always comes down to a materialistic, reductionist perspective. Now, the problem with inhaled anesthesia is that it goes everywhere in the body, and it affects many, many different things, from, you know, transcription of proteins to the lipid bilayers in our cells. We have not identified the one, if there is one, mechanism in which it, what Western medicine says, stops consciousness. But my perspective is a little different. The point here is we have to be thoughtful about how we're framing this inquiry. How are we going to come up with the answer of how does anesthesia work? The way we're approaching it right now is the way we approach defining how a drug works with all the other classes of drugs. But if we look at this problem closely, if we were ever to find or a set of molecules that we say, oh, this is the birth of consciousness right here, and anesthesia interferes with that particular interaction, and therefore we have an answer. But that actually is not going to be the answer, because we would then be forced to say that consciousness then is present only in those molecules, not in all of the other molecules in your body. And so we would be forced to say that only that part, whatever that be, you know, would it be a neural pathway or some structure in the midbrain or whatever it is, you know, we have identified things that are active while someone is aware and inactive when they're quote unquote unconscious. But those are actually just correlates for consciousness. They're not actually the source of consciousness, because if they were, then they would be the things that are conscious, and the rest of our bodies would not be. So what we're eventually going to realize is that as we deconstruct this problem into finer and finer detail, we are going to be stuck with a solution that doesn't make any sense. So that is why this field is so interesting, because it's an oblique way of getting to a very, very important concept. And it is backed up by a number of other things. So the first being that awareness and consciousness is non-local. And we have experiments that demonstrate this. Anecdotes, as well as documented cases where people have had near-death experiences in an operating room where they're being monitored, you know, physiologically, and by all accounts, they were dead. In our definition of what life and death is, they were dead. Yet they were able to return to awareness at some point and be able to remember specific details of what was said and done while they were apparently dead. And very often, you know, the experience is recounted from a place that is non-local to the body. In other words, you know, above the body or at the top of the operating room. So any paradigm that we wish to consider has to take into account of these exceptions. How do you explain that if you believe that awareness and consciousness is arising from our physical body? Moreover, I can also, you know, if there's anesthetists out there that are listening, we all should realize that if you give an amnestic, something that prevents your ability to remember things, then you can create a situation where a person in an operating room is interacting with us at a very high level. Like you can have a conversation with someone. If you've given them the amnestic before, the like something like Valium, for example, like a benzodiazepine, and they can go through a very minor procedure and then leave the operating room and have no recollection whatsoever of what happened. By every account, they were completely aware and lucid. But when you ask them about what happened in the last 25 minutes, they won't remember, and they'll think, you know, that their entire experience had been continuous. It's not like things ended and then they woke up. More than once, patients have asked me in those kinds of situations, you know, like, when is the operation going to begin, doctor? And I say, no, it's already done. And they look at me with such amazement in their eyes that they actually can't believe it happened. And I say, you know, look at your hand. And they look down and they see the surgical dressing. And they have asked the nurse or me several times in my career to take off the dressing because they could not believe that that actually happened. So we are now at a situation where we can say, look, maybe consciousness not only is non-local, but it is continuous, but we just do not have the capacity to remember what had happened to us during the operation or during the time that we would consider the patient to be unconscious. Now, the reason why this is so important, especially in the context that you've brought this up, Gary, in terms of like, you know, the world and how we're perceiving what we're being told, is that if we were to actually consider the possibility that consciousness is not only non-local, but it is transcendent, it is something that exists beyond the existence of the body, then that changes our entire perspective on our lives and on the world. Because ultimately, if we cannot be destroyed, all right, you know, the awareness that people possess, if that remains intact after the deaths of our body, now death itself becomes, it's no longer an absolute end. How then will that change the way we behave? How do we interact with each other? And how hard would it be for people to control us? if that sort of existential fear does not actually, is only an illusion. And what happens, of course, is that we become a very, very free and liberated species, and it becomes very, very difficult to control people at that level if the threat of death no longer exists. So that's why, you know, this particular topic to me is extremely interesting. And it is, in fact, you know, the basis of the book that I wrote a few years ago, exploring these topics, because I believe that we are being conditioned to, first of all, not consider the possibilities that you've talked about before with energy healing, the idea that we're actually energetic and not material. Those are the kinds of concepts that are very threatening to people in authority. I'm going to stop there and see what you have to say about that.
I appreciate your insights. In your book, you address the phenomena of near-death experience, and as you just mentioned, in the research of the late Ian Stevenson at the University of Virginia Department of Psychiatry, who investigated cases of reincarnation since the early 1960s. And that work is being continued by Dr. Jim Tucker. If the accounts of these phenomena are true, then it shatters the prevailing brain-conscious theory. And so how should we look at these phenomena today? And then how can we understand that if all life is simply energy, that's all it is, but in the energy is the message, and it's the message that we are influenced by, either a positive message or a negative message. Even well-intentioned parents will not always send the right messages to their children, and therefore the children is confused what is right, at what level. And so that's why we're not having the conversations we should. For example, I took a group of rats, just as one example, I took a group of rats, and half the rats were fed the doctor's diet. We went out and interviewed, at the Institute, we interviewed all up and down that whole east side or hospitals. And on lunch break, we would stand outside and ask someone, hi, I'm just doing a survey on what would you consider a doctor's diet? And they'd tell us, and what are you having for lunch? And we'd take that. What the doctors were using as their example of lunch, I made that into meals and gave it to the animals. I had to stop the experiment in under 3 weeks. It was supposed to be a year experiment because the animals are getting sick and I don't want to see animals die. But they were all sick under the doctor's diet. Well, how likely is the doctor would have advocated those to patients or not advocated diets at all? And loud dietitian. I'm a registered dietitian. And I can tell you, I never met a healthy dietitian when I was in dietetic school. The entire principles, what we were taught, was just based upon counting calories and grams of protein, but the source didn't matter. And I said, so you're telling me that a tablespoon of sugar, white sucrose sugar is the same as the same amount of fructose in an orange? Yeah. And I would challenge this. Well, so if everything is in the message, can we change the message? And if so, how do we change the message? Now, go back to your principle, what we were just saying. There's a basic principle that energy can never be created or destroyed. It is eternal. However, we can take energy that exists and manipulate it, like water coming across turbines, you create hydroelectric. A sun hitting a solar panel or the wind hitting a windmill, you create energy. But you had to have energy to create energy. So you have the sperm and you have the egg. Both are energies, and they go back throughout all of time. Every single person who had that energy could then create energy. So what happens when the physical body dies? Where does the energy go? That's the only thing that's missing when you're dead, is your energy. Everything else is there. Why doesn't science pay attention to that? Because the memory of life is in the memory of the energy, and therefore you cannot destroy the memory of life. And it's free then not to be limited to a body, but to the universal energy. Your thoughts, please.
Yeah, well, yes, you know, I'm 100% behind what you're saying here. You know, energy or your spirit, you know, that's at one level, it's just, it's semantic. But, you know, the idea of a transcendent nature is, you know, it's not eerie or weird. I mean, that is actually what most religions, you know, that's their fundamental tenet, whether it be a reincarnative soul or one that, you know, goes to the pearly gates. The point here is that there is part of you that is eternal. And, you know, we go to our places of worship and accept those things, but yet we come back into our world and behave in exactly the opposite way, right? Which is to try to maximize pleasure and time very often at the expense of other people, because we are acting as if that we have, that we're limited, and therefore we need to maximize. And that actually, that idea is what has formed, constructed all of the sociological institutions that we have right now. They're all based on the fact that we believe that we only have one shot at this. But in fact, fundamentally, it could be and probably is wrong for the reasons that we're discussing here. And, you know, the work that you brought up of Ian Stevenson is very, very important, because, you know, near-death experiences is another exception to this rule of materialism, which places the source of awareness, let's say, in your material body, but it's broken by near-death experiences. Now, the reincarnation aspect to this, we have to first understand that people are very biased about this, right? You know, there's a billion people in India that say, of course we reincarnate. Everybody knows that. And then, you know, the idea that they could be right and we could be wrong in our Judeo-Christian world is possibly an impediment to looking at this openly. But what's really fascinating about Stevenson's work is, to all those who have not read about his case reports, he has been able to find over 3,000 cases where very young children, from the time that they're able to first speak to their parents, start talking about another life that they had. It's interesting. And, you know, in this subset of the parents, rather than telling their child that they're crazy and stop making up stories, instead encourage them to tell them more, and it's documented. And but what's really fascinating is that in each one of these 3,000 cases, Stevenson and his colleagues were able to track down a family who had lost, or, you know, one of their family members had died prior to the birth of this child that claims to have lived another life. And this child is now connected with that family. And it so happens that the child recollects the entire family from which it had previously lived. And the stories are stunning, you know, where, you know, secrets between a spouse who had died and the surviving spouse were told by a child to, you know, an elderly man who lost his wife. And, you know, the child could recall very, very detailed descriptions of what had happened to her and could identify people in the family and identify the imposters that were placed to see if they could trip up the child. And the point here is that we're not talking about, you know, a person who does a past life regression and says that, you know, that they were Cleopatra. I'm not saying that those things don't exist either. I'm just saying that the truth is being uttered by the mouths of babes across the world. Now, how many of these things are we going to be able to dismiss as coincidences or things that we shouldn't consider? I say that we have to consider them all as being probably valid because it makes a lot of sense. But the point here is to realize that we're not going to be able to prove or disprove this possibility from a material perspective. We're talking about something that transcends materialism or molecules. So in Western medicine, as we're trying to, you know, get to the bottom of things. If that's all we're looking for, if we're only looking for molecules, that's all we're going to find. And what we're talking about here is something that is transcendent. More importantly, if we can acknowledge the fact that we are never going to find the answer to it with the tools we're using, we then have to be a little bit more thoughtful about what are we going to assume until proven. And my perspective on this is that if we as a species adopted the idea that we're going to come back, let's say, we have a transcendent soul that will be reincarnated, everything shifts. In a huge way. Why? Because the things that we're doing now are going to affect us when we die, right? So we can now start to take a much longer look at what our actions and plans are rather than just being looking ahead 2 years for the next election cycle or 4 years. We now can look 400 years ahead and 600 years ahead and realize that we are going to be the recipients of the repercussions of our actions that we're taking today. And moreover, we can also say that all of the horrible things that were done historically, that was us. We did that to ourselves. And at what point are we going to stop torturing ourselves and start working together? Because we keep coming back and creating the same stories. At what point are we going to be personally invested in our choice of actions and how we regard each other? So that is why I believe that this particular topic, awareness, anesthesia, energy bodies, and our soul, is not just some woo-woo kind of conversation. This has direct impact upon the resilience of our society and the health of our planet.
Well said. Let me add the following, please. I gave you one part of the answer with the doctor's diet. I had to stop the study to save the animals. The other side of that was I used only organic, fresh produce and a whole variety, and those rats lived 27% longer. That's without the intermittent fasting. I did the first study on that. Dr. Roy Warford, the University of California, received the credit for that 7 years later. But the Institute, as I would find out, wasn't sending out a lot of my articles because they were considered, even though I proved everything scientifically, they were considered too extreme. And the pharmaceutical industry was funding a lot of the work downstairs, the cancer work. I was the strange guy upstairs doing it with nature. So we actually showed that it's the energy within a given medium. So that's something physical. With the healing study I did with the 50 people trying to heal, and five out of the 50 were able to heal, including the head of nursing at New York University School of Medicine, Nursing, Dolores Krieger. And from that study, she created therapeutic touch, which is taught in all the nursing schools and nurses use it. Everyone has heard therapeutic touch. That was my study. And also the fact that an Italian scientist came in, University of Rome. He was there for 6 months, my laboratory, and we wanted to try, say, on a scale of 1 to 10, what causes 10, which is healing, enlightenment, happiness, freedom. And we found that first with the foods, there were certain foods, the raw foods, the organic foods, the unprocessed foods had the highest healing. And they were, right, the juices in particular were at the 10. But meat and sugar and alcohol were at zero. So you have this, it's like, okay, you have inflation, the dollar loses its value. What happens if everything you're taking in is at zero? There's no healing. Well, then you're going to disease. And we see this manifest. When people say change your diet and go on a healthy diet, change sedentary to exercise, these are energy exchanges. When you're saying be kind instead of being selfish, be thoughtful instead of being self-absorbed, be humble instead of narcissistic, Well, that's an energy exchange. We all know how we feel about being around people who are easy to be around. They're not wound tight. And a lot of people are just wound tight. And that's an energy. You're constricting. Fear constricts. Love expands. This is energy. Now imagine what we would do if we applied that to everything in medicine. We wouldn't just be using, and I'm all for whatever emergency medicine can save a life. That's good. But chronic care fails miserably. How can you reward yourself and be proud as an oncologist when 550,000 Americans die each year from your therapy and the cancer due radiation and chemotherapy cause secondary cancers? How can we reward when the energy is reward me for my efforts, not my results? Okay, I say no, then you shouldn't be rewarded. But they are super rewarded. I mean, huge rewards. You know, and we forget this whole dynamic in the human equation. Reward people for their outcomes, not their efforts. Because everybody said, well, I gave an effort. At what level on a pendulum did you really give the effort? What kind of energy did you use? And when we love someone, when our animal loves us, that's on a scale of 1 to 10, that's a 10, all right? And you don't get better than that. That's the pure spirit energy sharing, and it does not distinguish between races, cultures. It's a universal energy, and that's why I've always said everyone's invited to my table. You may not want to sit at my table, but you're not going to be excluded because of anything that would be superficial. And today, everything is superficial. Everything is balkanizing people, going back to tribal primordial instincts, and therefore, as you just said, the recurring problems that we don't change. We just keep repeating the same story, and people playing us. These people are not Democrat or Republican who are playing everyone who control the world. These people see themselves as universal citizens, meaning they're universalist. Okay. And they want everyone else to follow them. They weren't elected to this. They have a negative power and it's controlled by fear. So people acquiesce when they feel, well, doctor, you know better than I do how I should go about eating. Eat everything in moderation and don't worry about it. Take this COX-2 inhibitor Vioxx. You'll be fine. And 60,000 to 500,000 died. No doctor was reprimanded. No one lost their license. No one was sent to jail. No one lost any money. And they were able to keep their ill-gotten gains, about $7 billion after they paid a measly fine. That's a negative energy at every single level. But I've said repeatedly, who would go out and join in protest to overcome poverty, overcome homelessness, overcome inequality if they feared the consequences? Well, then no one. So you have to be liberated in your energy, your spiritual energy, in order to become that spiritual warrior where you're not afraid of loss because anything that a person took away from you is nothing that's essential to who you are. So that's why I think we have to look at the bigger picture of what energy does, and yet the scientific community is completely cult-like, religiously, monotheistically ingrained into one behavior, and they will not change. And therefore, I believe that we cannot change this system. Therefore, we must create new systems, allow the existing systems to collapse under their own corruption and hubris. Mm-hmm. We're out of time. I want to thank you very much for being with us. I want the audience to know that they can reach out to you whenever they want. Go to your website. Let me spell it, madhavasettymd.com. That is Dr. Madhava Sethi. Thank you very much for being with us. I look forward to another conversation.
Me too. Hi, Gary.
I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for being a part of our conversation with Remarkable Minds and our Progressive Commentary Hour. Have a nice day. You die, you know.